This is Democracy Now! Timothy McVeigh says he acted alone, but with the FBI's withholding of more than 3,000 pages of documents, does the lone bomber theory hold up? Today we'll talk with a reporter from the British newspaper The Independent, who's done an extended series on the Oklahoma conspiracy. Also, forensic artist Jeannie Boylan, called in by the FBI to do the original composite sketches, raises more questions about other people identified by witnesses. She speaks out for the first time. All that and more coming up on Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Israeli troops today shot dead five Palestinian policemen in the West Bank and launched air raids on the Gaza Strip, injuring some 15 people and eliciting Palestinian cries for international protection. Palestinian officials said five policemen, three of them under 21 years old, were gunned down at a roadblock near Ramallah after Israeli soldiers opened fire on them for no reason. Israeli Army Radio, for its part, said Israeli soldiers had detected, quote, suspicious figures near a military camp and opened fire on them. Overnight, Israeli helicopters, warships, and tanks blasted Palestinian targets in the Gaza Strip, including some around the headquarters of Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat, with rockets and shells. Meanwhile, Israel said today it will reject criticisms of the U.S.-led Mitchell Commission on the Palestinian uprising relating to Jewish settlements and excessive force by the Israeli army, while accepting the report, quote, in principle. President Bush this week will detail a new national energy policy that draws heavily on his free market ideology. Bush has tried to highlight conservation, but Vice President Dick Cheney, who headed the cabinet task force that crafted the sweeping plan to be announced on Thursday, said the administration will rely mostly on the production efforts of private industry, not government efficiency mandates, to solve the energy crunch. In a wide-ranging interview with the Wall Street Journal, the vice president detailed how Bush will try to clear away myriad government regulations and obstacles to greater energy production and easier distribution, including what will likely be a hotly contested plan to allow the government to condemn private property to ease power line construction. Meanwhile, the New York Times reported yesterday that the energy industry is drilling for natural gas, building gas pipelines, and constructing power plants at an unprecedented pace as companies respond to high energy prices by significantly increasing investment. Vice President Cheney has cited a litany of statistics, a shortage of refineries, power plants, natural gas pipelines, and other energy resources and infrastructure to warn of a trend towards supply shortages. The solution, he says, is urgent government action. But the latest statistics from government and industry analysts show the energy industry shifting into high gear, investing heavily in areas that were seen as unattractive just a few years ago. And California lawmakers are blaming the natural gas industry for the state's skyrocketing energy prices. A legislative committee says natural gas suppliers will be able to corner enough of the pipeline capacity into California to drive up prices. The panel says El Paso Natural Gas Company and its affiliates negotiated contracts with each other and boosted the cost of natural gas nearly 500% during the 12 months ending in February. President Bush has filled several senior environment-related jobs in his administration with pro-business advocates who have worked on behalf of various industries and battles with the federal government, largely during the Clinton years. Bush has announced his intent to nominate a mining industry lobbyist as the number two person at the Interior Department. He's chosen a lobbyist for the National Cattlemen's Beef Association to be the department's chief lawyer. His choice for number two at the Environmental Protection Agency was a lobbyist for Monsanto, the chemical company now devoted to agribusiness. He wants his chair of the Council on Environmental Quality, a lawyer who represented General Electric on its fight with the EPA over toxic waste sites. Missouri lawmakers approved a ban Friday on executing mentally retarded people. Nationally, the Supreme Court is considering whether such executions violate the Constitution's ban on cruel and unusual punishment. 14 states, not counting Missouri, bar executions of the retarded. And Dartmouth College officials permanently closed the Zeta Psi fraternity on Friday for publishing a newsletter that named and derided some of the women who it said had sex with the fraternity members and promised patented date rape techniques in a future edition. Last week, 101 faculty members at Dartmouth signed an open letter to the president and the trustees saying that they continue to teach, quote, female students and students of color who suffer from institutionalized practices of sexist and racist humiliation that fester largely unabated within secret fraternity culture. They wrote, "We ourselves have never felt more disappointed by the administration's failure to address the systemic and incalculable harm that both our students and our pedagogical work suffer by Dartmouth's acceptance and support of structures that promote such attitudes of entitlement and disrespect." In general, campus sentiment has been against Zeta Psi. On April 18th, when the campus newspaper, the Dartmouth, broke the story about the newsletter, about 250 students protested on the fraternity's lawn.
The first things I probably learned were Speedy Gonzales, you know, running across the desert, things like that.
So what's the deal? I get to confess all my racial bigotries? Is that the idea? And then you absolve me? Because I got a lot of sins.
Can you tell that I'm totally debased, humiliated? I did the bad thing. I did the bad thing last night.
If you're accusing Sister Fatima of a crime, such as murder, aren't you therefore committing the same crime by killing her?
That's left-wing pinko philosophy, if I ever heard it.
Michael Franti and an unusual mix by our music connoisseur and engineer, Anthony Sloan, here on Democracy Now! Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. This weekend, Attorney General John Ashcroft said that the execution of Timothy McVeigh would go forward on June 11th after announcing on Friday that the Justice Department was delaying the execution to allow McVeigh's defense attorneys a chance to examine thousands of pages of documents previously withheld by the FBI. Among the documents were hundreds of interview reports collected by FBI field offices during the course of their investigation into the April 1995 bombing in Oklahoma City. Justice Department officials insist the documents were not deliberately withheld and that nothing in them exculpates McVeigh, who has repeatedly confessed to carrying out the bombing. McVeigh himself has not ruled out the possibility of challenging his death sentence or even seeking a retrial, although he'd previously waived his right of appeal. Over the weekend, however, both Republicans and Democrats on Capitol Hill offered scathing criticism of the FBI's handling of the McVeigh case, which they say reflects deep problems within the agency. The FBI's withholding of the documents is just the latest in a series of major setbacks dating back to the FBI's deadly attack on the Branch Davidian compound in Waco, Texas in 1993, and the Bureau's recent failure to ferret out espionage by one of its highest-ranking employees, Robert Hansen. The FBI's withholding of documents has raised again the question of whether McVeigh and Nichols were the lone bombers. A new book by Lou Michael and Dan Herbeck, American Terrorist, Timothy McVeigh and the Oklahoma City Bombing, lays out the strongest case for the argument that McVeigh and Nichols acted alone carrying out the bombing of the Alfred T. Murrah Federal Building in April 1995. Michael and Herbeck contend that McVeigh's trial attorney, Stephen Jones, and others have fanned what amounts to a conspiracy theory linking McVeigh to far-right groups, claims they say are contradicted by McVeigh's own insistence that the country, quote, can't handle the truth because the truth is it was just me. But more than 6 years after one of the worst acts of domestic terrorism in American history, the question of whether McVeigh and Terry Nichols acted alone still lingers. Journalist Andrew Gumbel has raised these questions again in a groundbreaking series in the British newspaper The Independent, in which he argues that Timothy McVeigh acted as part of a larger conspiracy with the far-right Aryan Republican Army to carry out the Oklahoma City bombing, but that the FBI deliberately squelched investigations into the possibility of a wider conspiracy to increase their chances of convicting McVeigh. We're joined on the phone from Los Angeles right now by Andrew Gumbel, the U.S. correspondent for the London-based Independent. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much.
It's good to have you with us. Well, why don't you start off systematically laying out your theory, but start off by responding to the news of these thousands of pages of documents withheld by the FBI. You'd been doing your investigations for a while. Were you surprised?
I was very surprised that they came out when they did, which is to say, you know, 6 days before the scheduled execution. And to be honest, I still have no clear idea of exactly why that happened. The thing that I wanted to insist when I wrote my piece, which is interesting that dovetails very nicely with this new discovery, is that really anybody wanting to look at the truth of what happened at Oklahoma City has to go back to first principles, which is to say the evidence gathered by the FBI in the first few days immediately following the bombing. And as you know, there have been many, many conspiracy theories with the bombing, many of them from right-wingers who have possibly more concerned to denigrate the federal government than they are to discover the truth of what happened. And the thing that I wanted to insist on in my own head and also in what I wrote was that what you go back to is the evidence that was gathered at the time. And abracadabra, here we have a stash of documents. We don't know exactly what's in them, but we've heard from sources inside the Justice Department that they do contain 302s, which are witness statements taken by the FBI in the immediate aftermath of the bombing, and that they also include references to the so-called John Doe 2 and possibly other suspects who may or may not have been in Oklahoma City on the morning with McVeigh. So that's the first, you know, most important thing to say, is that almost everything that I've worked on, that other people have worked on, and I'm far from the first or the most eminent person who's done this, I've really looked at other people who have been working at this for the last 6 years pretty much indefatigably. What you see from the available evidence, and we don't have it all, we may be getting more of it in due course, is that there were at least 10 witnesses in Oklahoma City on the morning who saw Timothy McVeigh, but they all saw him with someone else. The same is true in Junction City, the town in Kansas where the Ryder truck that contained the bomb was rented 2 days before. None of the people who saw McVeigh that day were called onto the witness stand in court at McVeigh's trial for the simple reason that, yes, they could identify him, but they also would have said that they saw someone else. And even if the prosecution had managed to keep that quiet, it would have come out on cross-examination. So, you know, these are old, lingering doubts about the lone bomber theory that have existed since, you know, 96, 97, when the trial occurred, certainly. There are many logical flaws and demonstrable inconsistencies in McVeigh's own account, as expressed in the book that you mentioned by the two journalists from Buffalo, his hometown. Just to name a couple of things that immediately start to raise questions, one is his claim that he drove a fully loaded bomb the 300-odd miles from Junction City to Oklahoma City. If you talk to anybody who's got any experience of car bombs or truck bombs involving fertilizer, particularly in Northern Ireland, they'll tell you that this is a highly dangerous enterprise and the chances of blowing yourself up are extremely high. And the theory that I've developed, you know, based on other people's work, is that the detonators and blasting caps are almost certainly transported separately in another vehicle. One of the things that was cited on the morning in Oklahoma City was not just other people with McVeigh, but other vehicles. There was the Mercury Marquis, which was the car he ended up driving away in, but there was also a brown or maroon Chevy pickup dating back from the 1970s. Now, I know that's a very common thing to see in the Midwest, but it was seen consistently not just on its own, but in conjunction with the Ryder truck and with the Marquis. Now, all of this, as I say, the first part of my investigation was going through all the evidence for doubting that McVeigh acted alone, and I'm now completely satisfied that there is just an overwhelming body of work that shows that there were other people, there were other vehicles. Just the whole trajectory of how he drove into Oklahoma City, he said he simply drove the Ryder truck up to the front of the Murrah building, got out, and walked away. Well, that doesn't tally at all with what witnesses saw of the truck going all around town being seen on a derelict lot about a mile away where it's now believed the bomb was mixed at the last minute, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And these aren't just people who have a hazy memory. They have very clear memories. They had people, McVeigh, coming out and asking for directions, various other fairly clear indications that they would have had a strong memory. And as I say, they gave their statements in the immediate hours and days following the bombing. The big surprise and the thing that really made my investigation worth going into all over again was the discovery of the people who might have done this with him. And the group was discovered by accident. This group you mentioned in your introduction, the Aryan Republican Army, excuse me. we started off knowing about them because they were arrested and tried and convicted for a spectacular series of bank robberies across the Midwest that began in late 1993 and went on for quite a few months after the Oklahoma City bombing. And they were extraordinary affairs. They dressed up in masks and disguises. One of them would always jump over the teller's desks, open the drawers, pull out the cash, not bother with going to the vault or anything time-consuming like that, get out, leave a hoax explosive device on the premises just to sow maximum confusion. They would have bought a cheap getaway car, which they then immediately switch for their own car at a secret location, and they'd be out of there before anybody knew what had hit them. They did this 22 times. Now, the discovery after they were arrested that began to emerge is that they weren't just bank robbers. They were virulently ideological anti-government agitators who had clear intentions to raise money to attack federal buildings, attack the federal government, and eventually overthrow it.
Why wasn't any of this brought up at the time of the trial?
What I discovered, what I discovered as far as McVeigh's trial was concerned, that the whole trajectory of the trial from the prosecution point of view had been, we can't find John Doe 2 or John Doe's 345, which was almost certainly the case, that if they had half an idea who it was, they couldn't get the evidence together. And I think that the FBI was probably unlucky in that regard, in much the same way that they were very lucky to have found McVeigh so quickly after the bombing. And having set off on this course of denying that there were other accomplices, they had to stick to it to ensure that they got a conviction, because even if they raised suspicions that there were others, to bring that out in court would only dilute their case. Now, when it came to prosecuting the Aryan Republican Army, which happened not too much after the McVeigh trial, what I have found out from inside the investigation, I can't say who it is, but someone who was directly involved, they were extremely interested in the Oklahoma City bombing and pressed the various participants very hard on this. But what happened after that was that two out of the main bank robbery group entered the witness protection program in exchange for an agreement to testify against the others. And because this group and McVeigh, I would contend, led very secret underground lives, they operated pretty much entirely on aliases. They didn't stay anywhere for long. They didn't really know too much about each other. They didn't know each other's last names unless they happened to know each other from a previous life. They really kept it as secret as they possibly could. And I think the government just couldn't crack this secret network. And what they decided in the end was, let's make sure we convict them for the bank robberies, and we can't make the other stuff stick for now, so we'll just keep it quiet. And I think once you know, everything about the FBI's behavior in the release of these recent documents confirms this, suggests that, you know, once they have taken a certain course, and I think this is true of the way prosecution teams work in general, once they've decided how they're going to build their case, anything that threatens it becomes something that they want to quash as quickly as they possibly can.
We're talking to Andrew Gumbel, who has done a very provocative series in the British newspaper The Independent on Timothy McVeigh saying he was the lone bomber, but the FBI evidence supporting a right-wing conspiracy theory. Continue on the path that you are going on. And I should say, in a minute, we'll be joined by Jeannie Boylan, who is one of the preeminent forensic artists in this country and around the world. She was employed by the FBI to draw pictures of the composites that witnesses described her. And she has a remarkable story to tell about, in fact, what it is that she drew outside of Timothy McVeigh, the people who were identified. But continue, Andrew Gumbel.
You know, I can't possibly go into, it's a very intricate series of links and pieces of evidence that bring the whole thing together, and I apologize ahead of time if I can't explain it exhaustively in just a few minutes. But clearly, the number one question is, how do we know that McVeigh and this group of bank robbers were associates and that they planned the bombing together? If you're looking for a smoking gun, there isn't one. What we have is an overwhelming amount of circumstantial evidence that ties them together at various times and that indicates that together they had the skill, the expertise, the determination to carry this out. And according to the scheme that I've developed, and I have to mention two other people who've been absolutely key, without whom I would never have been able to work this out. One is a criminology professor at Indiana State University called Mark Ham, who has a book on the subject coming out in the fall. And the other is J.D. Cash, who is an Oklahoman who got into journalism only after the bombing and has been working indefatigably ever since. His name has surfaced a number of times, and there have been various doubts about his credibility, but the fact is he has had unbelievable access to government files in particular, which was partly thanks to his associations with the defense team at the time of the McVeigh trial. He has gone on to file Freedom of Information Act petitions to the FBI and other agencies for information. He's gone around the whole country interviewing and re-interviewing everybody. That's the backbone of where a lot of this stuff comes from. The association, as I say, began in late 1993. They were all in western Arkansas at exactly the same time. They knew the same people there. There are various reasons to think that they did indeed meet for the first time on that occasion. One of the strongest pieces of evidence linking McVeigh to them is the fact that he was completely broke at the end of 1993, had massive credit card debt, amongst other things, and within a few months he was producing wads of $100 bills to repay a loan from his father, giving money to his sister, talking about taking part in bank robberies. If you look at the first 10 or so bank robberies committed by the group, McVeigh's whereabouts are unaccounted for in the days immediately before and immediately after in all but one of the cases. And it goes on like that. There are numerous contacts of places, times when they're in the same place at the same time and very likely to have met. The most striking time then is just 2 months before the bombing when Timothy McVeigh abruptly interrupts a trip around Kansas gun shows he was undertaking with Terry Nichols and takes off for Arizona at exactly the same time as the bank robbery group do precisely the same thing. They've never operated outside the Midwest. In the prison memoir written by one of them, who's now dead because he was found hanged in his cell, he expresses grave reservations about going to Arizona, but the leader of the group tells him that's where they're going, so that's where they go. They say they're off to rob an armored truck. McVeigh, according to the records of his telephone calling card, was calling armored truck companies before he took off. They both go for an extended period. McVeigh zips around a little bit, but basically they're in Arizona for 6 weeks. A ammonium nitrate-based bomb, very much like the one that went off at the Murrah building, explodes outside someone's house in Kingman, Arizona. And when the owner of the house goes to confront somebody who knows who he suspects of having done it, he goes to his house, finds Tim McVeigh and someone else who he doesn't recognize. I'm just giving you a little flavor. There are 100, 150, 200 instances like this where people bump into Tim McVeigh or bump into somebody else. There's a bomb exploded. These people are in the same place at the same time. Another very striking piece of circumstantial evidence, and I stress it is all circumstantial, but as I say, once you see the volume of it, you begin to build up a pattern. And nothing really seriously contradicts it, or nothing that I've seen, is that the day of the bombing was also the day that an old member of a far-right terrorist group was due to be executed in Arkansas. His name was Richard Snell, who very curiously in the early 80s had hatched a plot of his own to blow up the Murrah building, which was later abandoned. He was actually put on death row for the murder of a state trooper and also a pawn shop owner. When he was due to be put to death, the plan was to bring his body back to Elohim City, which is a compound for Christian Identity believers, heavily armed in eastern Oklahoma, which has also been linked to the Oklahoma City bombing. So there are all kinds of links there. Now, part of the bank robbery group was based at Elohim City. They and a group of others went there in early April, and the plan was to wait until the execution took place And the burial happened at Elohim City the next day on April the 20th, which also happens to be Hitler's birthday. These people are very much into the symbolism of dates. And all of a sudden, on the 16th or 17th, we don't know exactly when, but certainly a few days before the bombing, all these people who theoretically were waiting for the funeral of Richard Snell disappear from Elohim City, and we don't know where they went. And, you know, one possibility of where they went is to go help with the bombing. In the case of two others who were expected to be at the funeral, they went to other parts of the country and made sure that everybody knew where they were. One can again surmise that they were establishing alibis. So that's where the body of the evidence comes. Now, a lot of this is corroborated, as I say, from eyewitness testimony, people whose descriptions match the descriptions of the members of this bank robbery group. As I say, there are many, many more elements that I haven't got time to go into now, but I hope that gives you a broad picture of where my research took me and where it's taken some of these other people.
Yeah, we have to break for stations to identify themselves, but we're going to come back with you in just a minute. Again, we are talking to Andrew Gumbel, who is the U.S. reporter for the British Independent, who's done an extended series on the Oklahoma conspiracy. The Aryan Republican Army could become a force to be reckoned with, was his May 10th piece, and his pieces continue. You are listening to Democracy Now! We'll continue with him in a minute.
Porém, a singeleza do seu gesto, esse é presente, deixa eu ficar.
You're listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman, as we continue with Andrew Gumbel, the U.S. reporter for the British Independent, as the latest revelations come out that the FBI withheld thousands of pages of documents from the McVeigh defense attorneys. The Attorney General of the United States has put off the execution by 30 days, but says that it will not be delayed any longer. And we'll see how these FBI documents factor in. The lawyers for Timothy McVeigh are now going through them at a very fast pace. Andrew Gumbel, can you again describe what these documents are, specifically the 302s, for example?
Well, I mean, I don't know exactly what they are. I don't think anybody who hasn't seen them knows exactly what they are. What we have been told by sources inside the Justice Department, who've spoken to the Washington Post and others, is, as they say, that they refer to witness statements taken in the immediate aftermath of the bombing. And if you talk to any of the people who've worked on the defense of either Timothy McVeigh or Terry Nichols, what they will tell you is that from the beginning, there was this monumental struggle to get the prosecution and the FBI to hand over all the discovery materials, and that anything that they held out on and were eventually forced to pass up because of an order from the judge, it invariably referred to John Doe 2 or other accomplices, witness sightings, which didn't fit with the prosecution pattern of what happened on that morning, or in Junction City 2 days earlier where the Ryder truck was rented. So an educated guess, plus the information from these sources who've spoken to the Washington Post, would suggest that, it is, once again, material that relates to this subject. Now, people who have looked into this and who've interviewed far more people than I have say that this estimate of this current estimate of 10 witnesses who saw McVeigh and or others on the morning may actually be very low, and there may have been 24 of them. And because the FBI hasn't passed on the details of who it spoke to in Oklahoma City, we don't necessarily know exactly who these people are. We don't know how reliable their testimony is. You know, there are many, many questions. The other comment to be made is when the government says that these papers are not likely to be exculpatory to McVeigh. Now, that may be literally true. He has, as we know, confessed and, you know, taken pleasure in taking sole credit for this crime. And it's entirely possible that, you know, there's nothing in these papers that would say that McVeigh didn't do it. I don't think there's any reasonable grounds to suppose that he didn't. That doesn't, you know, what these papers represent or the possibility they represent is not that they will contradict McVeigh's guilt, but that they will completely undermine the basis of the government's presentation of the case in court. And, you know, I would be very happy if the government was forced to acknowledge that its lone bomber theory has got many, many flaws in it. And I would be also happy if the release of these papers led to more light being shed on exactly what did happen. For all I've written and for all everybody else has investigated, you know, there are many, many things we don't know. For example, even if we suppose there were 3, 4, 5, 6, however many it was, people in Oklahoma City on the morning, we don't know who was who. You know, there are guesses about who these people were on the morning. We certainly have a good idea of what group of people they were drawn from. But there's still an awful lot to be found out about exactly what happened.
What about McVeigh's insistence that he acted alone? What are his motivations for this if, as you say, it isn't the case?
Well, again, looking at what he said in the book that was recently published, listening to what his lawyer has to say on the basis of extensive contact with him, it seems clear that his strategy from the moment he was arrested was to take sole credit or, as you know, keep the credit as restricted as possible to him, Nichols, and Michael Fortier, who's the other person who was prosecuted, who was a friend of theirs in Arizona who gave him some kind of logistical help. That's clearly been his strategy. And if you look at the evidence that I've uncovered and the way that the Aryan Republican Army functioned, which was on a kind of revolutionary cell basis whereby nobody knew more than they absolutely had to, so that they wouldn't give away any more secrets than was strictly necessary. They wouldn't rat each other out. One can make a kind of theoretical supposition that McVeigh and Nichols and possibly Fortier belong to one cell in the organization. You know, you can call it the operational cell. And, you know, once they were caught, it was their number one job to make sure that they were the only ones who fell under suspicion and to keep completely quiet about everything else. Now, one very interesting new piece of information we have is from McVeigh's trial lawyer, Stephen Jones, who represented him right up to the time of his death sentence, then resigned his position. And as a result of the recent book in which McVeigh rips into him in no uncertain terms, he has decided that their client-attorney privilege is effectively waived, and he's gone on the record with a number of very interesting new revelations. One of which is that Timothy McVeigh expressly instructed him to spread stories within a month of the bombing that he'd admitted his guilt, which is an extraordinary thing to do for someone who's going to go on to plead not guilty at trial. And Stephen Jones produces a signed document from McVeigh saying that the piece that appeared in the New York Times, which is where it appeared, saying that he talked to two people and admitted his guilt, was accurate and that he stood by it and that it was done at his express instruction. So clearly there's a strategy going on there. And incidentally, the two people he spoke to were Stephen Jones and one other member of the defense team. You know, he has two interests, really. One is to protect the other people involved. And the other interest is that if he is going to be held up as responsible for this, you know, awful crime, he might as well go out with a bang. You know, better, what's Stephen Jones' phrase, better demonization than oblivion. You know, this way he can go down as one of the great criminals in the history of the United States. He can hope to be, you know, achieve some kind of martyr status. He can hope that the far right will put up his picture next to Adolf Hitler and Bob Matthews, the leader of the order in the 1980s. Whether they will is another matter, because I think even in the circles of the far right, there's an acknowledgement that McVeigh's role is not quite as prominent as he would like to have us believe. But I think that's his strategy. That's why he waived all his appeals. That's why he wanted to be put to death with a maximum media glare on him. And I think, you know, ironically, people might think that this reprieve or delay or whatever you want to call it from the Justice Department is somehow a favor to McVeigh. I think quite the opposite. I think it has messed up his plans royally. And from my point of view, I can only hope they continue to be messed up as much as possible until the truth comes out.
Timothy McVeigh's defense attorney, Rob Nye, told reporters that McVeigh is willing to take a fresh look and evaluate the information, saying he's very resilient, he's capable of evaluation of new information and making a decision based upon that information. That was also very interesting to see the defense attorney, Nye, questioned on one of the networks about how cold McVeigh was and how he referred to the killing of people, and particularly the children that were killed at the Alfred Murrah building, as collateral damage. And Nye made a very interesting comment. He said, yes, he thinks that's terrible to refer to people as a collateral damage, innocent civilians who've been killed. But he pointed out that is a military term. Can you talk a little about Timothy McVeigh's experience in the Persian Gulf War? He was one of those who was involved with a highway of death, where Iraqi soldiers and others who had actually at that point surrendered and were going home were bombed by the Allied forces. And I believe McVeigh was one of those who bulldozed over live people. Is that right?
Yes, I think so. And I'm very glad you brought this up, because I think it's a very interesting connection. As you say, collateral damage was a phrase that was used extensively during the Gulf War. The time that really stuck in my mind was after the bombing of the bomb shelter, the Al-Amira shelter in Baghdad, when 400 people, all civilians, mostly women and children, were killed. And it was referred to as collateral damage. And there are all kinds of rather chilling parallels between what McVeigh did at Oklahoma City and the way in which the U.S. military has described its various own brutal attacks on civilians, innocent civilians. You know, you can go back all the way. One very interesting quote I just found and I happen to have right in front of me, so I'll read it out if that's okay, is from the pilot of the Enola Gay, which is the plane that dropped the atom bomb on Hiroshima. And he wrote afterwards, please try to understand, it's not an easy thing to hear, but please listen. There is no morality in warfare. You kill children, you kill women, you kill old men. You don't seek them out, but they die. That's what happens in war. And the chilling thing about a phrase like that is that it's exactly the terms in which Timothy McVeigh cast his own justification. And I think there's a very strong argument to be made that, you know, he went into the army. There were a number of reasons why he probably should never have gone into the army, should never have received military training, but he did. Saw the things he saw in the Gulf, as you say, was certainly a witness, if not an active participant, in the mowing down and burning and wholesale slaughter of Iraqi troops retreating from Kuwait on the road to Basra. And I think if you add into that mix, you know, a healthy dose, or an unhealthy dose, rather, of far-right ideology, outrage over what happened in the standoff at Ruby Ridge in Idaho at Randy Weaver's cabin, even greater outrage at what happened at Waco, with, once again, you know, government vehicles, including Bradley fighting vehicles, which is the very vehicle that McVeigh drove or was inside in the Gulf, moving in on the compound of the Branch Davidians, the place being set on fire, him being convinced that it was the government that deliberately set it on fire and killed all those children. And you begin to see a kind of psychological profile. There's another thing to add to the mix as well, which is that McVeigh's admitted having experimented with crystal methamphetamine, which is a drug which was extremely common in Kingman, Arizona, where his friend Michael Fortier lived and where he stayed extensively. It's also a drug that, you know, gives you a kind of false sense of empowerment and also makes you highly paranoid. And there have been many studies done to show that it's almost the perfect, you know, right-wing, conspiracy-oriented, paranoid person's drug of choice. There is some evidence, again, it's circumstantial, based on his behavior more than anything else, that he continued to use crystal meth, and certainly I've spoken to experts who say there's no such thing as a casual user. But, you know, however extensive his usage was, you have paranoia induced by drugs, you have far-right ideology, you have a kind of brutalization effect of having been in the U.S. Army, seen action in the Gulf, and to have kind of tasted the dicey morality of killing civilians. And you have a very powerful psychological motivation for what drove him.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Andrew Gumbel, for joining us. And I want to ask, finally, how this story is being covered in Europe, particularly England, and what people want to know about Timothy McVeigh and understand about what happened in Oklahoma.
Well, all I can tell you, because I'm based over here, is that, you know, from early this year, after it was clear that McVeigh was going to be put to death, there was a huge amount of interest and a lot of pressure was put on me to do a lot of legwork and to come up with whatever I could. Interestingly, there's been a sort of tradition of the British press looking into the White Conspiracy. There was a piece by a colleague of mine in The Guardian Weekend magazine a couple of weeks ago that looked into some of the same things as I've looked into. At the time of the bombing and the trial, there was a reporter from the Sunday Telegraph who took it upon himself to prove somehow that there was a link to the federal government and that they were somehow culpable, either through negligence or something worse, for the bombing. And I would treat that material with a rather large degree of caution, but the fact is there's been the interest there in Britain all along. I don't know how to account for it exactly. In continental Europe, I'm not sure. I was living in Italy at the time of the bombing, and it received blanket coverage there too. So, I think there's a feeling that there has been many, many links throughout the world between the United States and acts of violence like this and terrorism. But it's extremely rare that it's happened on American soil. I think there's also a fascination with the idea that the American authorities, for all their power and resources, can be quite this imperfect when it comes to exploring something very troubling in their own backyard. And perhaps, writing for a foreign publication, I have the luxury of a little more perspective on that. I would welcome as many colleagues as possible to look into this. I think it's an endlessly fascinating subject.
There's
an awful lot more to discover, and I hope it all comes out in the end.
Well, Andrew Gumbel, thank you very much for being with us. We'd hope to be joined by one of the leading forensic artists in the world who did sketches for the FBI, composite sketches, during the investigation of Timothy McVeigh. And I guess we'll be having her on tomorrow. Unfortunately, we were not able to get her on today. Andrew Gumbel, again, the British reporter who's the U.S. Journalist working with the independent newspaper in Britain. You are listening to Democracy Now!, that series, The Oklahoma Conspiracy. You can find on web, www.independent.co.uk. You can also just go to webactive.com and listen to Democracy Now!, any of the shows again, and see the contact information for them. Stay with us. You are listening to Democracy Now! Free Speech Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. A major new report out from the National Labor Committee. Workers in clothing factories in El Salvador are earning just 29 cents for sewing National Basketball Association, that's NBA, jerseys that sell for $140 each. The investigation also uncovered an allegedly suppressed report by the El Salvador government into working conditions in close to 230 maquiladoras making clothing for the U.S. market. We're joined on the telephone right now by Charlie Kernighan, who is executive director of the National Labor Committee in New York. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
It's good to have you with us. Well, explain where these jerseys are being made.
Well, El Salvador right now is really the eighth largest exporter of apparel worldwide to the U.S. We estimate about 634 million garments. And as you pointed out earlier, there's 229 maquila factories or export assembly plants in El Salvador producing these goods for export to the United States. And Nike in particular, Nike, the NBA, Puma, universities, there are three factories they use, Hermosa and Qifeng and a factory called Exmotica. And we investigated those factories along with several others. And what we found confirmed this suppressed Ministry of Labor report, which we can come back to. But what we found were workers being forced to work overtime, sometimes 19-and-a-half-hour shifts from 6:30 in the morning until 2 a.m. They'd sleep on the ground, and then it'd start all over again the next morning at 6:30 or 7:30. If they didn't work overtime, they were fired. Sometimes the overtime was on a daily basis, and sometimes they were working seven-day weeks. We found that they set enormously high production quotas so that workers had to sew, for example, 2,000 Nike T-shirts a day, like the sleeves. So every worker's a specialist. So that means a woman would have to sew a sleeve on a Nike T-shirt at the rate of one every 15.3 seconds, nonstop, the entire day. And if they didn't meet their production quota, at the end of the day, they had to stay for free, unpaid for another hour or two until they met their quota. And if they consistently didn't reach their quota, well, they'd be fired. We found drinking water inside Nike contractors' factories that contained bacterial levels 429 times greater than allowed under international standards. The water contained animal and human fecal matter. We showed it to several doctors who said to us, don't even touch this water. Don't wash with it, let alone drink it. We found surveillance cameras on the factory floor. In one factory, they actually had surveillance cameras in the bathrooms. We found limited access to health care, 100-degree temperatures, lint dust-filled air. But the biggest issue for the workers was, of course, the two issues. One, starvation wages. They're getting 60 cents an hour, and even according to the government of El Salvador, that wage is one of abject poverty. And the government itself says to climb out of this misery and into relative poverty, you'd have to double the wages. So the workers are really living in broken-down conditions, dilapidated homes, not enough food, while they're making $140 NBA jerseys. And, of course, the other issue was the complete total denial of worker rights. Freedom of association is violated every single day. There is not one single union with a collective contract in El Salvador in any of these factories, because every time the workers meet to learn their rights, they're fired and blacklisted.
Charlie Kernighan, you are targeting now NBA players for the first time, taking a new strategy. These jerseys that are made that cost $140 each, that say that are, you know, that are the real symbol of the NBA. Who are you targeting in the NBA to get them to speak out?
Well, we're trying to get to the bottom of this. David Stern, the commissioner, of course, we hold responsible to end the mandatory pregnancy tests, you know, to end the discrimination against women, to end the union busting, the blacklists, to end the 19-hour shifts, to end the forced overtime, to improve the health and safety conditions, to improve wages. But an interesting angle here would be the NBA players themselves, you see, because their names are obviously on these jerseys. It'll say Lakers, O'Neal. It'll say Knicks, Sprewell, you know. And, you know, I doubt that these players have the slightest idea what's going on here. But if one of them would stand up and say, wait a second, they perhaps would be shocked that their name is on a jersey made by young women forced to undergo mandatory pregnancy tests, you know, and paid these starvation wages and abused and screamed at, bathroom visits limited, filthy drinking water, forced overtime. Maybe they would say, maybe one of these players would say, wait a second, I don't want my name on a jersey made by women who stripped of their rights and paid starvation wages. If even one of them would stand up, it would have a profound impact, all across, not just El Salvador, but all across Latin America and beyond.
Have you gotten any responses from people like Shaquille O'Neal? Or?
No, it's very difficult for people like us to reach them, but we understand that a spokesperson for Commissioner Stern said that, there would be an immediate investigation. The Gap has said the same. Nike says that this is just old rehashing of old materials and all. But, you know, we have to now hold the NBA to a real independent investigation of conditions. You see, no one can dispute this. The Ministry of Labor in El Salvador took money from the U.S. government, from USAID, the Agency for International Development, to survey working conditions in the free trade zones in El Salvador. This was done in the face of all of these constant international and national denunciations of worker rights violations all across El Salvador. So USAID came up with the money, gave it to the Ministry of Labor. The Ministry of Labor took the money, and no one knows how this happened. They went out and hired some researchers to carry out the study, but they hired honest people. This never happened before. So all of a sudden, here go these Ministry of Labor officials with a USAID grant. They're going out to the free trade zones to meet with the workers, to meet with the company owners. The companies received these researchers with open arms. They brought them right into the factories because in the past, the Ministry of Labor had never once criticized worker rights violations in any of these free trade zones. They'd given these companies complete impunity to do whatever they wanted, blacklist, fire workers, force them to work overtime, anything they wanted. So, but this one time, these researchers went in, they met with the companies, they met with the workers, they spent months and months and months in the free trade zones, and they come out and they publish their report. And they say that there's forced overtime, mandatory overtime on a daily basis under the threat of being fired, and that sometimes the workers are working all night and forced to sleep in the factory. They talk about the excessively high production quotas, and if you don't make it, you stay for free, because it's your obligation to complete your quota. So you'll spend another hour or two working. And again, they comment that if you don't reach these production goals, you'll be fired. They talk about the broken health of the women because the strain of the work, the long hours, the pressure, the screaming, the yelling. They talk about 90 to 100 degree temperatures in the factory. They talk about the air being filled with lint dust from the cut cloth. They talk about the unsafe drinking water. They talk about the unhygienic food. They talk about the lack of access to health care. They talk about the union busting, and they say that there's an anti-union attitude in the maquila that any time workers try to meet, to organize, they are immediately fired, illegally but with complete impunity, and the companies maintain blacklists. They even go on to say the workers are adamant in these factories that the Ministry of Labor inspectors who come to the plants are on the take from the companies and are receiving money. And their final conclusion of the study, of course, also that the wages that are paid are beneath subsistence wage levels, their final conclusion is that the Ministry of Labor would need to be completely overhauled if it was to do its job to protect worker rights. Now, that report was issued last summer in August 21st of 2000. Evidently, the Vice Minister of Labor looked at the report, signed off on it without even reading it. He was too lazy. So this report goes out. This first truth report goes out across the country. They had distributed 100 copies the first day to NGOs and to think tanks and to business people, and of course the businesses saw it, went completely wild. The very next day, the 21st of August, those reports were recalled, the 100 or so reports that had been distributed. The printing of the reports was stopped. The reports that had already been printed were destroyed, and the researchers who did this truthful research were fired and laid off. And the Ministry of Labor went on television and said, oh, there's been a huge mistake, we're very sorry, but now we're going to do very serious research. So, in a sense, the research that we conducted in 11 different factories meets to a T what these researchers from the Ministry of Labor found on their study, which was funded by the U.S. government. So the Salvadoran government has a problem, because this is the perfect example of laws which are on books. China has laws, labor laws on books. Everybody has laws on books. They sound great. They read great. They're really touching. But when you get down to the ground, when you get down to the concrete, and you're with these women, these workers, you see that their rights are violated on a daily basis, nonstop, systematically, and that the companies get away with it with impunity. So this has a lot to tell us about the free trade agreement of the Americas and the so-called voluntary codes of conduct. And if you have the ability to exploit these young women at will with total impunity, the only way to stop that is with sanctions and with core labor standards attached to these trade bills. So I think that, you know, hopefully this will add a little reality to this whole debate around the free trade agreement to the Americas.
So we're talking about when it comes to El Salvador and these factories, the government report that was suppressed, 229 apparel factories. We're talking about apparel that's made for the NBA. That's the apparel that has the names of the athletes and the numbers commanding a premium price. We're talking about clothing that goes to where? To Nike, to Reebok, Walmart, the Gap?
Yes, Kohl's. Universities across the country, for example, we had University of Ohio, Ohio State basketball shirts made in El Salvador, $55 shirts. The women were paid 22 cents to make them. So it was all across the board. El Salvador is a very major producer, but yes, it's for all the big retailers like Walmart, like Kohl's, for the universities, for the NBA.
What do you think is the most useful way for listeners to get in touch with the NBA players?
Well, I wish they'd call us with some ideas, because this is, in baseball, for example, this is actually quite a major issue. In the National Baseball Players Association, when you go into a store and you buy a baseball shirt and has the name of a player on it, that means that the royalties from the sale of that garment go to the union, to the National Baseball Players Association, and it funds their strike fund. And after their strike fund is sufficiently met and funded, the money goes back to the players in royalties. Like some insider told me this one time, they were actually embarrassed, that checks were going out to the baseball players for $100,000 after the strike fund was sufficiently met. That means that the National Baseball Players Association is actually funding its strike fund and receiving hefty royalties.
Charlie Kernaghan, we have to end the program, but if people want to get in touch with the National Labor Committee, where can they call?
Sure, they should get in touch with us at 212-242-3002.
That's Charlie Kernaghan of the National Labor Committee with the latest report on maquiladoras in El Salvador. And that does it for today's program. If you'd like to mail us, send the mail to mail@democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced by Chris Abrams and Brad Simpson. Anthony Sloan, our engineer. From the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of the band and the fired, from the studios of you, our listeners, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Democracy Now! We'll be right back.